think we've got some pretty exciting results. Let me just begin by giving my perspective on where we are in fundamental physics right now. And I think the wonderful thing from my perspective about Planck, WMAP, and other CMB experiments, and the LHC, is the results have turned out to be much simpler than expected in most theoretical paradigms. And so this is really pointing us towards the universe, towards a simple explanation of the basic phenomena in the universe. And the challenge, I think, is to find the physical principles which will predict such extreme simplicity in nature. And inherently, I don't believe we've found those principles yet, but I think they may be in the offing. Now, in this talk, it's really in the nature of a mathematical exploration, and I think by sort of playing games within mathematical laboratories, we can hopefully develop more powerful principles and methods to tackle hard problems. And there's no problem that's harder or more important than the cosmic singularity. And I think the continuing failure of paradigms like inflation to even speak about the singularity really is something that can't go on forever. And so I would say that a compelling theory of the Big Bang has to resolve the cosmic singularity from which everything we see emerged. And secondly, it has to provide a measure on the space of cosmologies. And I think the multiverse is kind of the ultimate catastrophe from this point of view. We can't really talk about a theory unless we have a measure. All the theories we know do give you a measure. The challenge is to make sense of it. It's the measure that comes into the path integral. It's the same measure we use for computing vacuum fluctuations in inflation or whatever, but we have to make sense of that measure more generally, the measure for the background geometry. And so these problems are related to very profound issues in quantum gravity. The kinetic energy for the scale factor of the universe has the wrong sign, so the Hamiltonian for GR is not comprising positive terms. In fact, it has to be zero, and that happens through a balance of positive and negative terms. Related to this, the Liouville measure is divergent and must be carefully regulated for it to make any sense at all. And finally, the Euclidean action for gravity is unbounded below. All these things are related to fundamental property, fundamental sign in gravity. And so what do we do about these? Well, I'm going to try to tackle them all within a very specific mathematical laboratory, which will be M-theory and sort of as kosher as you can get, M-theory, in asymptotically ADS space-time. So this is not intended to be realistic in any shape or form, but it's trying to address those profound conceptual puzzles. And what we'll see is that they are directly related to some unfamiliar phenomena in quantum field theory and very basic phenomena in quantum field theory, which when resolved, actually lead to new kinds of quantum field theories. So, you know, one of my inspirations is Paul Dirac, and he gave this lovely quote, "When I've been at a loss how to proceed, I've just had to wait until I've felt the mathematics lead me by the hand, and it led me along an unexpected path, a path where new vistas opened up." So I think this kind of mathematical exploration, one should be very careful to keep it as simple and principled and conceptual as possible, and the hope is that it's going to open new doors, literally, because it will show us how a universe can actually bounce through a singularity. Yeah? Wow. I'm just at a loss. So you're saying you don't believe the singularity theorems? And that's exactly what they say.
No.
Okay. All right. You may doubt there is a cosmic singularity. I don't.
I still think it's very interesting.
Okay. 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 ADS-CFT. So ADS-CFT is, what I can say in response to that is either the standard Big Bang or any inflationary model that has been proposed has a singularity in the past. Are you denying that or? Okay, thank you. Well, okay, you can have a closed universe, De Sitter space. Yeah, that's a set of measure zero. I mean, that particular geometry.
Yeah.
There seems to have been a singularity in our past, therefore it's an interesting question to try to resolve singularities. Singularities are generic in GR, let's put it that way. And yes, by very special choice of essentially time reversal invariant initial conditions, I can make a bounce, and that seems an extremely artificial thing to do. Okay, so ADS-CFT. This is a wonderful idea, which is the idea that a theory with gravity in the bulk of space-time, in an asymptotically anti-de Sitter space-time, is equivalent to a theory without any gravity living on the boundary of that space-time. And the boundary is only defined up to conformal transformations. And so you have to have a conformal field theory living on the boundary. So this is, if true, this conjecture is not proven, but there's lots of evidence in favor of it. And if true, it's a wonderful theoretical laboratory to address these questions. One of the best, perhaps the best understood example is M theory, which is only partially formulated, but nevertheless, M theory, an extension of general relativity, on ADS4 cross S7, which is one of the simplest compactifications, is the simplest compactification of 11D supergravity on a seven sphere cross four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. And it turns out it's useful not just to take the seven sphere, but to further reduce one of the dimensions of the seven sphere, which is a circle fiber on the seven sphere, by modding out by a group ZK. And that's useful for technical reasons, that as we take the limit as k becomes large, and not so technical actually, as take the limit as k becomes large, essentially this dimension shrinks to zero, and what would have been a membrane stretched along that orbifold becomes very narrow, and in that limit it reduces to a string theory. So this is one of the most one of the simplest compactifications of M theory, and this is dual to a three-dimensional conformal field theory on a cylinder, which is just the boundary of anti-de Sitter space-time. Now that setup, if one adopts supersymmetric boundary conditions, is not very interesting because nothing happens in the bulk. There is no cosmological evolution, that's just a stable, boring anti-de Sitter space. But what one is able to do within the framework of ADS-CFT is use slightly different boundary conditions, which are still anti-de Sitter invariant, but which are not supersymmetric. And these boundary conditions allow for more interesting cosmological evolution in the bulk. So for the purpose of defining the boundary conditions, these more general boundary conditions, you take this theory, which in the case of a low energy description, so this would be when the ADS radius is much bigger than the string scale, then a reasonable description would be in terms of Einstein gravity and some scalar fields representing the size and shape of the seven sphere. And in particular, you can truncate the theory to a single scalar field representing a quadrupole of the seven sphere, a particular quadrupole, and this is the Lagrangian for that particular scalar field coupling to gravity. I want to emphasize we're not actually truncating the theory, we're simply trying to define some particular boundary conditions, and for the purpose of defining the boundary conditions, you perform this truncation just to identify a particular mode that you want to treat slightly differently than the usual anti de Sitter boundary conditions. So this potential, you can see when you truncate it, the potential is weird from a cosmologist's point of view. It's unbounded below, and it looks like minus cosh phi. And there's a particular tachyonic mass associated with the field. So now you consider general asymptotically ADS solutions of the equations of that theory. So the scalar field is very small. It's going to be balanced near the top of its hill. And asymptotically, it will tend to the top of its hill. That's the class of solutions you want to consider. So these are asymptotically ADS solutions. And basically, there are two arbitrary functions living on the cylinder, multiplying e to the minus r and e to the minus 2r, where r is the proper radius going outwards. Now, the isometries of the anti-de Sitter space are obviously a symmetry of the problem. The spacetime, by definition, is asymptotically anti-de Sitter. So you can perform a global transformation at large distances on the anti-de Sitter space, and that should be a symmetry. That symmetry turns into the conformal group of the conformal field theory living on the boundary. So there's a direct correspondence between the isometry of the bulk and the conformal group in the boundary theory. And this leads you to identify, and I may have time to explain in a little bit more how this happens precisely in this setup, but this leads you to identify alpha, the first coefficient, with a certain operator. Its dimensions are determined by the number occurring in the e to the minus r. So this is an operator of dimension 1, and beta has to be an operator of dimension 2, basically because the isometry group will act on those exponents to produce a certain scaling. So it turns out that in the simple setup I've described, the operator corresponding to alpha can be identified with the square of a scalar field, a canonically normalized scalar field, and beta with the source for such a scalar field. In other words, in three dimensions, a scalar field has dimension half, so the operator would be phi squared, and the source would be something like phi to the fourth. Supersymmetric boundary conditions set either alpha or beta to zero, and this is static and stable and boring, but a more general class of boundary conditions relates beta to alpha through a dimensionless coupling, lambda, and that forces beta to be lambda times alpha squared. And these, it's understood through the correspondence that this specifying these more general boundary conditions corresponds to adding a deformation to the boundary conformal field theory, which is lambda times that operator cubed in this case. So essentially, the way you can think about it is by imposing a relationship between beta and alpha, you now, the system, the gravity system now has a completely well-defined evolution. There's a Cauchy problem and so on. And in the conformal field theory language, you literally have changed the field theory by introducing a new term which breaks supersymmetry and creates some interesting dynamics. So Hertog and Horowitz studied this setup in the context of cosmology, and what they realized is that for every choice of this coupling lambda, there is a cosmological instanton solution. So if you think about the Euclidean version of ADS, which is just a 4D hyperboloid, that would be perfectly symmetrical, or maximally symmetrical. But if you impose these more general boundary conditions, it turns out there's another solution, which roughly speaking looks like a lump in the middle of that hyperboloid. And so that is still, that is O4 invariant, but it's not, it breaks some of the symmetry in the problem. So they realized there were these instantons, and that if you take one of them and continue to real time, so the boundary space-time becomes, the asymptotic space-time becomes ADS, then this lump in the middle of your H4 becomes a bubble, and the bubble expands at the speed of light, and in the interior of the bubble is an open universe which is collapsing to a big crunch. Now, it's obviously true, I haven't shown it here, but if I continued the instanton to the past, then I would have a big bang with a similar picture. So the entire space-time defined by the instanton is actually a big bang followed by a big crunch. There's a very nice thing that happens, which is that for the boundary conditions I described, actually near the singularity, the 11D bulk geometry turns out to be 1 plus 1 dimensional Milne times flat space, and this was exactly the picture we had, that the M theory dimension would disappear linearly in time. There's no Riemann curvature anywhere, and this is a very natural setting to consider in which all mass scales, in particular the string tension, vanish at the singularity. So this is the setup you really can describe. The collision of two boundary brains can be described in this way. Now, the dual conformal field theory was first identified just two or three years ago, by Aharoni et al. It's a Chern-Simons theory, so it's a three-dimensional gauge theory. But all that matters for us in most of the talk will be that this theory has a number of Higgs fields, scalar fields. And this phi to the sixth deformation is essentially this Higgs field, some combination of the Higgs field, to the sixth power, and that's the deformation we use to describe the non-supersymmetric evolution of the dual theory. The ADS-CFT correspondence relates the M in the gauge group of the dual theory and the K, which is the same K that I mentioned in the ZK, the orbifolding of the circle. So they relate those parameters. Those are the two parameters in this theory, in the dual theory, M and K. And the correspondence says you should take the limit where both of those numbers are large. Take both of them to be large at fixed Tuft coupling, which is the ratio of M to K. And if you do that, then the ADS radius in Planck units is is MK to the quarter, so that's always big. So the ADS radius is large in Planck units. But in string units, it turns out to be the Tuft coupling to the 1/4 power. So basically, you can take the large M limit of this theory, but at weak Tuft coupling, your anti-de Sitter radius is smaller than the string length. So the string length is the scale on which quantum fluctuations in the length of the string are large. And so that's really a stringy bulk. You can't describe it with Einstein gravity. But if you take the other limit, where the anti-de Sitter radius is large in string lengths, that's a strongly coupled description of the dual theory, the large M dual theory, then that should correspond to Einstein gravity with small alpha prime corrections. So for most of this talk, I'll discuss the theory at small Tuft coupling, where the bulk is stringy. But at the end, I'm going to switch to just solving the Einstein equations in the bulk. And these solutions should predict the strong coupling behavior of the dual theory. And as we'll see, actually, they're pretty similar. Qualitatively, the dual theory seems to be, shows the same behavior in both descriptions, with a certain caveat, which I'll mention. But the indications are that for the phenomena we're really studying here, in the theory, those phenomena, the qualitative phenomena, seem to be independent of the Tuft coupling. So essentially, I can describe the boundary theory in a certain, at weak coupling. I can describe the bulk theory at strong boundary coupling, but Einstein gravity. And we see mirrors of, we see the same phenomena happening in both descriptions. Now, Hertog and Horowitz interpreted their instanton as describing tunneling from an anti-de Sitter space to a big crunch. However, this is problematic because ADS is infinite, and if you can tunnel at one point in the space-time, you could have tunneled anywhere. And Daniel Harlow made the point that if there's a finite rate of tunneling per space-time volume, then way out in the wings of the anti-de Sitter space-time, you're going to nucleate infinite numbers of bubbles, and these will come in and collide with the bubble you thought you were studying. And so the interior of the space-time is just full of bubbles, and it's one big mess. And so you're not describing an FRW cosmology, but you're describing some extremely inhomogeneous space-time, which depends on initial conditions. So this should sound familiar from eternal inflation. In eternal inflation, you have similarly puzzling results where what you get seems to have infinite numbers of bubbles and depend on initial conditions. Now, what we'll find is that actually, in this context, we're able to resolve this problem completely. The infinity disappears. The infinity is a result of not regulating the theory properly and defining the theory properly. And when you do define it, in the way we shall define it, the interpretation of the bulk is not a case. It's not anti-de Sitter space tunneling into a bubble. We will define the ground state of the bulk space-time for once and for all. And it's not unstable. So from our point of view, this was just asking the wrong question, and we'll see exactly how that happens. So we will sum over all these instantons and show that collectively they define a non-stable and non-singular cosmological phase of the boundary CFT, and by implication, the bulk. It's a bit like a time crystal in that the background state of the theory, the CFT, exhibits spontaneous time dependence. It refuses to live on a flat static space-time. The boundary theory, in fact, insists on living in a time-dependent space-time, a three-dimensional de Sitter space-time. And within this phase, as I'll get to right at the end of the talk, I believe we can describe precisely the passage, the approach right up to the singularity, and the passage across it. So along the way, we encounter many strange phenomena. The first thing is you discover that the dual CFT has a Hamiltonian which is apparently unbounded below. It's unstable. That's how it develops this time dependence. Secondly, it has infinite numbers of bubbles, just like the bulk does, each one of which contains a singularity if you continue it to real time. However, if you sum over all of them in Euclidean time and then continue to real time, you get a completely regular state. So all these bubbles add up to just a definition of the ground state. We are absolutely required to deal with ADS in global coordinates. The dual theory makes no sense in flat space, but it's well-defined on a de Sitter space-time, three-dimensional de Sitter boundary of anti-de Sitter space-time. Conformal symmetry is really the heart of everything, and we shall take great care to treat it properly. It is spontaneously broken, but there is no Goldstone mode. It's a surprising consequence. this essentially happens because if you break conformal symmetry and you also break Poincaré invariance at the same time, there's no requirement to get a Goldstone mode, and this is exactly what happens. Now, the dual theory is very interesting. If we take the limit of small gauge coupling, just forget the gauge fields and fermions, we just have scalar fields. And these scalar fields are described by an ON invariant model. The M in the gauge group, essentially, the Higgs field there was bifundamental, so it has 2M squared components. And the N in the ON model is 2M squared in terms of the original theory. But it's just an ON vector model in three dimensions with a sextic potential, which makes it conformally invariant. So it was realized, so this is a very interesting model for historical reasons. It's actually the model, as I mentioned at the bottom, this is the same model that Ken Wilson won the Nobel Prize for by finding the IR fixed point using the phi squared and phi fourth interactions in d equals 3 using the epsilon expansion. But we're interested in something else, something completely different. We're interested in the UV properties of this theory. We want to describe the entire bulk. And so that requires really understanding the boundary theory right up to the highest energy scale. And this theory has been deeply paradoxical for three decades, okay? The theory at large N possesses a UV fixed point, a perturbative fixed point. Its beta function goes like this sextic coupling minus the coupling cubed. And so at lambda 6 equal to 192, the beta function vanishes. And this is controlled by the 1 over n expansion. So even if, as long as n is large, all the higher n corrections will do is just shift the fixed point slightly by 1 over n corrections. But it's a reliable result that there is a UV fixed point at large n. Now, in this deformed ABGM, exactly this calculation shows there is a UV fixed point in the ABGM model at this value of the sextic coupling, the deformation coupling, when the gauge coupling is weak. The ADS-CFT calculation using gravity in the bulk actually indicates a UV fixed point even at strong Tuft coupling with similar properties. So for simplicity, in most of this talk, I'm just going to take the theory to be exactly at this fixed point and not worry about the running of lambda 6 at all. I'll just set lambda 6 to 192, and this is the simplest case. Now, lambda 6 is positive, so you may ask, why is the Hamiltonian unbounded below? It looks like a great theory. Has positive kinetic term and positive potential term. However, there's an easy calculation which shows that the Hamiltonian can be arbitrarily negative after renormalization. So all you do is compute the expectation value of phi squared. I've left out the factors of n in those. There should be an n multiplying that integral. There are n components. So compute expectation value of phi squared in a Schrodinger wave functional for a free field of mass m. And you just get the obvious naive result in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And as you raise m, omega is square root k squared plus m squared. And as you raise m, obviously you decrease phi squared. So the actual answer goes like the cutoff minus m. And the key thing is that minus sign. When I renormalize, I remove the lambda, but I leave the minus m. So the expectation value of phi squared is actually negative. And this means the expectation value of the potential term, even though it was lambda phi to the sixth with positive lambda, the expectation value of the potential term actually goes like, I'm sorry, that's an email. I better switch this off. The expectation value of the potential term is negative, And that allows you at large lambda to make the potential, at large lambda, it means the potential energy is negative and it defeats the kinetic energy. And so the Hamiltonian can be made arbitrarily negative by making M arbitrarily large. And so for lambda bigger than 16 pi squared, which is less than 192, this theory has no ground state in flat space time. So I think in view of time, I'm just going to tell you in words, don't bother reading the equations. So you have this theory that Hamiltonian is unbounded below. So now study the time evolution. All right, so put up some quantum state and study how it evolves towards sort of falling off the cliff. You can do that in the large N approximation, and you find, not surprisingly, that phi squared diverges like 1 over t just by dimension. So as t goes to 0, we start at negative t. As t goes to 0, phi goes to infinity. Yeah. Yeah, in the large N approximation, you're not tackling that. It's like doing semi-classical. Okay. This is simply motivation. This is simply motivation. It's a clue as to how to get rid of this instability. So the main clue is that phi squared goes like 1 over t. It blows up as 1 over t if you did it in flat space. Okay, and then you would hit the singularity. Now, however, the theory is Weyl invariant. You're at a UV fixed point, and there's no trace anomaly because you're in three dimensions. So the singularity can be removed via Weyl transformation. So we were in flat space, going like 1 over t. So just rescale phi by t to the half, rescale the metric by 1 over t squared, which is the right scaling, and you find phi squared is a constant in de Sitter. So you've removed the singularity by transforming spacetime to de Sitter spacetime. So the picture is the following, that this is, remember, the boundary of our bulk. If we slice the bulk in Poincaré slicing, then our boundary would be flat space-time, and the dual CFT is badly defined. But if we took a global slicing and with this conformal factor, the appropriate one for 3D de Sitter, then the phi squared is regular everywhere on the boundary. So this is the picture we end up with, that we need to think about our boundary theory as 3D de Sitter, and then we just see geometrically there's an obvious fact that this 3D de Sitter space avoids the singularity. It just stays outside the bubble, the center of the bubble wall, and therefore never encounters the singularity. So in this way, your dual theory is completely regular, and you can evolve it all the way to t equals plus infinity, and it will remain, and the theory will remain completely regular. Now that's sort of half the story, but we really want, that was a very simplified calculation, lowest order computation. We'd really like to formulate this dual theory fully. And so we've developed its Euclidean formulation. In its Euclidean description, it lives on a three-sphere. So you want some full description of this theory on a three-sphere. This part I don't have time to deal with. I'll skip over that. So let me discuss the dual theory. As I said, it's basically just phi to the sixth with a conformal coupling, and one can define the partition function. You introduce some auxiliary fields. This is the typical large N technique, is to integrate out phi, because you're interested in studying the theory in a O-N symmetric phase anyway, and phi is not O-N symmetric. So it's convenient just to get rid of it and replace it by two fields, both of which are O-N symmetric. So essentially what you do is introduce some Lagrange multiplier fields, S and rho, and formally you use this kind of identity, that the original interaction is the interaction. You see, if I do this S integral, roughly speaking, this is delta of rho minus phi squared. And that means this becomes the phi to the sixth when I integrate over rho. So that's a formal technique. But what I want to emphasize here is that when you do this, it's actually completely up to you how you pick those contours for S and rho. So the choice of contours in the complex plane, these two quantities, are actually completely, you can choose them how you like, as long as the theory makes sense, as long as the path integral converges. And it will end up, I mention this, because we'll have to choose unconventional paths for S and rho. We'll have to choose imaginary paths for both of them. So again, we study the saddle point equations in the large N limit, this time in a static setup on S3. You find there is a saddle point which spontaneously breaks conformal symmetry, the SO41, down to SO4. So it does not break the isometry of the boundary. The boundary is S3. You don't break that. But you break the conformal group to SO41 down to SO4 through developing a non-zero vacuum expectation value for a field with dimensions. Now, actually, that's one instanton. But it turns out there's an infinite family of instantons. And you can think of it from the bulk point of view that the simplest instanton is where the bubble, or the original instanton in the bulk, was in the middle of the space-time. And so in the boundary, it looks constant on the three-sphere. But if you move the bulk instanton around, then the instanton on the boundary should become deformed to basically a blip somewhere on the sphere. And what you find is that there's a four-parameter family of such instantons. They have a size, A, and they have a center, which is somewhere on the sphere. And you have to integrate over this entire space. So all of these bubbles, or sort of virtual bubbles in the bulk, occur in this boundary theory, and you simply have to integrate over all of them. Now, as I mentioned, every one of them, if continued in the boundary, gives you a bubble in the boundary with a singularity, with the scalar field falling off to infinity. But instead, what we do is sum over all of them in the Euclidean region, and it turns out you can do that. And only continue the theory when you've completely done that sum. And then you find the boundary theory is completely regular and stable. Now, the trick to do this is to identify the moduli space, that four-dimensional space of instanton parameters has a metric on it. And you can show that that metric is just H4. And that's not too surprising, because from the dual point of view, the location of the bubble should be parameterized by H4. So there's this infinite moduli space you have to integrate over. But there's a simple trick to regularize that infinite integral, and it looks like this. So this is the volume of d-dimensional hyperbolic space. And let's study it as a function of d. So it turns out that that integral converges if d is between 0 and 1. Okay. So the volume of hyperbolic space is completely finite if d is between 0 and 1, okay, whatever it means. And now you can analytically continue it to any value of d you're interested in. It turns out at d equals 2, it's a negative number. At d equals 3, it's infinity. There's a pole in the expression. And d equals 4, it's 4 pi squared over 3. So this is a finite number. And this is a completely kosher way of regulating this infinite integral over moduli space. So now the question is to, having regulated the integral over moduli space, we now try to understand how to define the partition function. I will just show you a picture. So essentially, you can integrate out one of these two fields, S and rho. You're left with an integrand in terms of S. This is the homogeneous mode of S. It's the unstable mode. You're left with an integral which has a unique contour along which it converges. And so this is in the complex X-bar plane. You have to integrate S along this imaginary contour. You have to integrate rho along a similarly imaginary contour. And basically, the two I's cancel. And we can show that the partition function and the correlations are completely real, correlations of phi. Our claim is that the CFT defined by this choice is well-defined and stable when continued to 3D de Sitter space. And this is a technical thing, but basically we can, as well as computing correlations of phi, as I told you about, we can compute S, the SS time-dependent correlator, and show that it's completely stable. So this trick of rotating contours looks like a kind of cheap trick. It doesn't always work. Right? So in particular, if you tried to study, let's say, some inflationary potential with a maximum for its scalar field, with a scalar field maximum, you have a Hawking-Moss instanton. And if you do the same procedure, you'll easily find that it leads to an unstable theory, even if you tried to rotate the contour. So it only works in some cases, and it happens to work in this case. So using this, we can perform the integral, calculate the two-point function, and it has nice behavior at short and large distances. So we believe we have shown that the dual CFT exists and is stable. It can't be defined on flat space because that trick for regulating the integral just doesn't work in flat space. And so we believe we have a well-defined vacuum and S matrix from the Big Bang to the Big Crunch. Crossing the singularity, I think I'm going to skip unless somebody asks a question. We haven't written this up yet, but we will do. So I think I wanted to say one thing because I mentioned this at the beginning. You can study this theory. You see, if this coupling lambda 6 is large, though I emphasize this is completely under control because perturbation theory is in 1 over n, it's not in lambda 6. So, but we are interested in studying this theory at large lambda 6. We can control the stringy phase, we believe, that's under very good control. The question is what happens when we turn on the gauge coupling? So is switching on a gauge coupling going to qualitatively alter the behavior of the theory? Now, fortunately, when the gauge coupling is large, you just have to solve the Einstein equations. And this lambda 6 is exactly the parameter appearing in your boundary condition. So you can study the behavior of the instanton in the bulk as a function of lambda 6. Okay, so when you take lambda 6 to be large, there's a unique solution for each lambda 6. And as you take lambda 6 large, these perturbations of ADS scale in the following way. It happens to be exactly the same scaling as you see when the Tuft coupling is small. And furthermore, the action scales the same way as a function of lambda 6. At large lambda 6. And so I believe this is evidence that nothing dramatic happens. Maybe some numerical coefficients will change, but nothing dramatic will change as you go from weak Tuft coupling to strong Tuft coupling. And there are plenty of other examples in ADS CFT correspondence where the same is true, where the qualitative phenomena you see at weak coupling are actually the same as strong coupling. And I think this is evidence in favor of that. So thank you very much.
So I have one. Maybe I'll start. I was wondering if you could comment on how well we understand the bulk description in the case where your dual field theory is strongly coupled. I mean, so you presented this picture of the bulk where I have, you know, many bubbles. And it sounds like one of the pieces of evidence for that from the boundary theory was just that you identified the moduli space as being the same as, you know, the places that I'd put in different positions. Is that the only piece of evidence, or can you present more evidence that that
No, okay, so the first thing is that at strong Tuft coupling, according to the correspondence, the bulk should be described by Einstein gravity. Okay, so we think that should be the right description. So in Einstein gravity, there is this bubble, but there are, you know, you can move it around. So there's a moduli space in the Einstein gravity description, which is exactly the same moduli space as we had in the weakly coupled description. And so now you have to integrate over that moduli space. And so again, you will have to regulate that integral. The same regularization will make it finite. And then to define the gravitational theory, you have to do some kind of contour rotation, which we don't know how to do in gravity. Gibbons, Hawking, and Perry argued long time ago that in Euclidean quantum gravity, you had to rotate the conformal factor of the metric to imaginary values. And that sort of, in spirit, is the same as what we're doing. The difference is that because the dual theory is under very good control and doesn't involve gravity or black holes or anything like that, the dual theory, you can really do it. And so I think the goal would be to understand, to sort of see what you do in the dual theory, to see what you must have been rotating in the bulk to make the path integral well-defined, and try to do the same in the Einstein gravity description. But so far that has not been done.
Follow up to that, and it's, I see what you're doing mathematically, and I think that's a nice little miracle with the integration over the moduli space, but wave your hands a bit, give me a better physical intuition for what is actually being marginalized over and what that's actually means in terms of wiggly things on surfaces and all that.
Yeah, it's a very good question. But actually, Rob Myers and I have discussed this. I think Rob can maybe comment on it. But in the description of a black hole, the dual theory is supposed to be in a thermal state, right? But now if you say, let me try to do a microcanonical description of the dual theory, obviously it seems to be a well-defined theory. I can just fix the energy rather than the temperature. And if you try to analyze what happens in the bulk when you do that, then the geometries seem to be singular. Is that a fair statement? I'm asking you. That's what you told me. What? Oh, okay. So I think the point was that if I tried to microscopically identify states in the dual theory with the bulk theory, that I would find the corresponding bulk geometry would be singular, would contain singularities. So people have been able to identify a thermal state in the boundary with a smooth bulk geometry, but a microscopic correspondence doesn't seem to work. So, you know, so I would say, I mean, if that is correct, and you're the expert on the black hole case, is that a fair statement that I said? Uh-huh.
So qualitatively, I'll agree with you.
Okay. Good enough. So I would It's really trying to, I would, my interpretation of it would be that if you try to, have too classical a picture for what's inherently quantum, you're going to hit singularities. It's the same thing as when you study collisions of electrons in QED. You don't want to go and look ask the question, what is the classical field around the electron? It's just the wrong question. So if you find that a bubble corresponds to a singular interior, perhaps you asked the wrong question. You should be standing back and say, look, this whole thing is really a quantum process, and don't focus on a classical picture of bubbles. So absolutely. That's right. I mean, the beauty of ADS, you know, if you do quantum gravity, the basic problem is you can't really imagine two spacetimes coexisting. Yet in the quantum theory, that's what they must do. So in the boundary, because it's rigid and fixed, you can fix quantities on the boundary while allowing many different spacetimes to coexist in the bulk. Right. Yeah. Right. Yep. Yep. No, I don't know. he hasn't specifically raised any objection, but that doesn't mean that he agrees. Right. I think it, well, personally, I think it would be hard to disagree. I don't see any, yeah, go ahead.
So at some point at the beginning, you were mentioning a spontaneous breaking of conformal invariance without a Goldstone excitation. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh, yes. So you see, that's a very good question. Okay, so basically, we have this conformal group, which is SO4,1. Now, from the bulk point of view, it's the isometry of ADS space. From the boundary point of view, it's SO4,1 acting on a three-sphere. Now, you say, what the hell does that mean? Because the conformal group is really defined in flat space. So what you do is projectively map the sphere to flat space, and then the conformal group is defined on flat space. So the definition of the conformal group on a three-sphere is first map your quantity to flat, do the special conformal, and map it back. Now, if you take the simplest instanton, it's homogeneous on the three-sphere. But when I map it to flat space, it's a lump. Okay. Now, that lump obviously breaks conformal symmetry, because it has a scale. And it breaks Poincaré translation symmetry, because it has a position. Now, you say, is there a Goldstone mode? No, there isn't, because basically it's like a monopole or a soliton, right? The global symmetry just moves it around. So it's the Goldstone boson becomes a modulus. It's just the center of mass position. If you broke a global symmetry everywhere uniformly, you know, like in the Goldstone mechanism with some scalar field that got a VeV everywhere, then yes, there's a massless mode. But if you have a lump, the massless degrees of freedom are, you know, a finite, they're not a field. It's just the position of the lump.
Yeah, but
lump.
In a more general sense, you can interpret, for instance, the position degree of freedom as a Goldstone excitation in this particular case.
Yes, that's the modulus. So yeah. I would say it's not a Goldstone field, it's a modulus.
Yeah, it still has the right properties, though. No?
That's instance, correct.
It non-linearly realizes the broken symmetries.
That's correct.
Okay, we're going to have one last question.
So for a non-specialist, I'm trying to sort of reconcile this picture with sort of the fairly recent mathematical results of ADS-4 just being generically unstable and churning out black holes. And it this is related to the previous question. I write in thinking you're not really sort of resolving the singularity picture in a cosmological sense. You're sort of fuzzing it out and not probing scales that are,
well,
know,
I think for this particular type of singularity, we're simply evading it, okay? That's what we're doing. We're picking our boundary such that it can collect all the information from the bulk, right? So all the information is there and is represented on the boundary. So it is a complete description of the theory once the bulk has literally disappeared. So I didn't really talk about this, but this is how you would use it to describe a bounce, is that the boundary of the space-time is this ADS, is this de Sitter 3. Its boundary is a sphere, a two-sphere at the infinite future. And that two-sphere contains all the data. Rather, it's the approach to that two-sphere, which contains all the data of the of this collapsing space-time. And so in a sense, it's a boundary of a boundary, because the bulk has actually disappeared on the singularity. So now if you want to continue past the singularity, you glue another boundary, similar boundary of a boundary of another space-time onto it, impose conformal symmetry, which turns out to give you a unique rule to match the two space-times together, and continue to reconstruct the future space-time. So there does seem to be a unique prescription for going past the singularity in this way of resolving it.
Okay, let's thank Neil again.